Hear ye, hear ye. This Honorable Appellate Court for the 2nd Judicial District is now back in session. The Honorable Susan F. Hutchinson presiding.
Please be seated.
Your Honor, the final case we've got this morning is 2-25-0143. Elise Clark, formerly known as Elise Bald and Roger Clark, plaintiff's appellant in JV Architecture Group Incorporated, Jonathan Andiris, Matthew Ron Builders Incorporated, Michael Barabal, and Mildred Montgomery, defendants at the lease. Arguing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. James G. Arguing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. William G. Turner.
All right, Mr. McConnell, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is James G. McConnell, and I represent Elise and Roger Clark, plaintiff appellants in this case. The principal question in this case is why is the first sworn statement in a construction project so important that the Illinois legislature has passed not just one, but two separate statutes requiring contractors who work on owner-occupied single-family homes to warn the homeowners to ask for a sworn statement before giving the contractor any money. And I'll answer that question.
Well, hang on. Before you answer that question, let me ask one, okay? Supreme Court Rule 341 requires that appellant's brief include, quote-unquote, a concise statement of the applicable standard of review for each issue with citation to authority. You didn't do that in your brief, right?
I cited all of the applicable authorities.
Did you give a concise standard of review for each issue in the case?
I don't recall.
You didn't?
Okay.
Why not?
The standard of review is, after the trial, the judge signed an order granting a mechanic's lien. My clients satisfied that judgment in order to protect themselves against the accrual of continuing interest and then appealed pursuant to the applicable provisions that we cited that Mr. Cherney consented to have that judgment reversed. And it's strictly a matter of law. There's no questions that I'm aware of in this case involving admissibility or refusal of admission of evidence.
And so you agree with all the findings of fact that were made by the trial court after the trial?
No, I don't agree.
Well, what's the standard of review with respect to the trial court's findings?
There has to be some evidence supporting the findings. And I'm going to talk about why there isn't. And that's why I asked the initial question that I asked. Why is the first sworn statement in a construction project so important that the legislature has passed two statutes at different times requiring contractors to warn owner-occupied single-family homeowners to ask for a sworn statement before giving any money?
So what's the standard of review on that issue?
The standard of review is he admits he didn't do it. There's no conflicting evidence that shows that there was any effort to do it. And, in fact, if you look at the deposition that's in the common law record beginning at C-753, he didn't give a sworn statement in the beginning. He didn't give a sworn statement before he recorded the mechanics lien. And he refused to give sworn statements throughout the discovery process.
No sworn statement was ever requested, correct?
They did request what Elise referred to, and there's no dispute that she did request. They didn't use the magic word sworn statement. And the reason they didn't use the magic word sworn statement is because the warning with the magic words wasn't in the contract, and they didn't give the consumer rights brochure. If those are, in fact, magic words, but in my view, Elisa's request for a cost breakdown when confronted with five-figure additional costs for what the contractor described as changes,
change orders,
can't be answered if there's no principal initial sworn statement that says what's the cost breakdown, trade by trade, supplier by supplier of labor, supplier by supplier of materials.
But that's not what she asked for in that email. She asked for a cost breakdown. She did not ask for who did it, who did what.
She didn't. She said, I want to know where my money's going. Meaning, who's the electrician? Who's the carpenter? Who's the plumber?
Well, that's not what she said.
She said, I want to know where my money's going.
The trial court, I mean, to the extent it's a fact of, that the trial court can find, as opposed to us looking at it and deciding if, isn't that the standard for a sworn statement? Trial court found. They didn't ask for a sworn statement. So
they didn't use
it. But just a second. Let me go on. And I see that you apparently contend we can look past that and decide what that request was. And I'm still talking. So no need for you to
gear up. I'm listening.
But the trial court went on to find in detail that the purpose of that request for a cost breakdown was to renegotiate the entire project. It was not to make sure they weren't exposed, let me finish, to liens from the subcontractor. So what do we do with that?
Let me answer the question I asked. Why is the primary first sworn statement so important? It's important not only to prevent liens, but to identify who waiver should come from and to show the initial cost breakdown of the project. I've been practicing law in the construction industry for 52 years.
But I think really my, what I said, what do we do with that, was really, and I should have been more clear, related to Justice Burkett's questions about the standard of review, because if that's a fact that can be found, it's harder to undo an appeal than a determination of how to construe the statute, which might be de novo.
The judge found that they didn't use the magic word sworn statement. The reason they didn't use the magic word sworn statement was because the draftsman of the contract, Mr. Bieritz, both contracts, refused to include the statutorily required language from Section 5B of the Mechanics Lien Act. And the reason he did that is because if he gave them the magic words, they would have used them.
I know your argument is basically the failure to abide by the statute voids the contract, essentially.
Yes.
And you, I know your position is contrary to the Miller case, where the Supreme Court said, we note the statutory violation does not automatically render a contract unenforceable. The mere fact that a contract was performed in violation of law will not invalidate the resulting lien, if not seriously injurious to the public order, etc.
And when was that case decided, Your Honor?
Well, it's 2010.
And when was the Section 5B passed?
Section 5 didn't, how did it change substantively?
Section 5 said, not only, it didn't say not only, Section 5 didn't address the consumer rights brochure, it said this specific.
No, you're talking about the different issue now. I'm talking about the sworn statement.
I'm talking about the warning that Section 5B little I says must be in the contract in 10-point, boldface, all caps, that says, ask for a sworn statement before you give the contractor any money. And they didn't put it in the contract the day they collected $10,000 for architectural services which are lienable under the Act, and they didn't put it in the contract that they characterize as the construction contract. And the reason they didn't do it is so they could ask for exorbitant change order costs when there's no starting point made known to the owners of what, if I want an extra window and it's going to cost $1,500, what could I take out to balance that? I don't know, because you didn't give me the initial sworn statement that the law says you should have warned me to ask for.
Is it, let me ask you this, does Section 5, is there any remedy that's offered under Subsection 5? I mean, did the General Assembly carve out a separate cause of action for violation of the Act?
The General Assembly said you have to do it.
Now, I'm asking you a question, please. Did
the General Assembly carve out
a separate remedy for violation of the Act? Yes or no?
The General Assembly said it's got to be in there.
My question is, did the General Assembly carve out a cause of action for violation of the Act? Yes or no?
No.
Okay.
The cause of action has been decided by the courts after that law was passed that if you don't do it and you don't record a sworn, you don't issue a sworn statement before recording a mechanics lien, which has been the law since before either one of these statutes was passed.
Northwest Miller covers whether or not a contract is invalidated for failure to provide a sworn contract or statement pursuant to Section 5.
Northwest Millwork was decided before Section 5 was enacted, several years before. And for that reason, Northwest Millwork's opinion does not discuss Section 5, because the lawyers who were here and the judges who were here and the ones who wrote that opinion didn't know that Section 5B was going to come into existence. It came into existence years later. And there is no case decision decided after 5B was enacted that says the contract is still valid.
But doesn't Section 5 say it shall be the duty of the contractor to give to the owner and the duty of the owner to require of the contractor before the owner or his agent, architect, or superintendent shall pay a cost? So we're talking about, did the owner request or, require?
That's what Section 5A says.
Yeah.
Section 5B says, if you're working on an owner-occupied single-family home, you must give this warning.
It says shall provide, right? It says shall provide.
Provide the warning. And they didn't. And that's why the magic words, sworn statement, were never used in Elise's request. But let me go back to what I was going to read.
It's a repetition of what's in subsection A. The law requires that the contractor shall submit a sworn statement. It's a repetition. I mean, it's reinforcement. It reinforces what subsection A says. Right?
Okay.
Am I correct?
Subsection A. Can I answer the question I started asking at the beginning of this?
If you answered the question.
I've been working as a lawyer in the construction industry for 52 years. I have done 100-story office skyscrapers. I've done single-family homes. I've done multifamily residential. I've done municipal construction. I've done industrial construction. I've done commercial construction. I have never been in a project that didn't involve changes. Never. In 52 years was there a project with zero changes. If you don't have the initial sworn statement before any money is handed over, there is no basis for determining what the change order cost should reasonably be. If you're putting in a kitchen and your initial estimate is for quartz countertops, and then you decide, I want an extra window, what can I take out to balance the cost of that extra window? Without that first sworn statement, there is no answer to that question. And that's why contractors leave them out.
So you're saying that your clients would have automatically taken out something that they wanted in that house originally based upon a change order. Is that in the record?
The record shows that on April 30th, 2021, JB Architecture asked for change order price increases of $76,500 without any detailed justification and said, if you don't give us the check, we're going to stop working. On May 4th, 2021, after some discussions, JB Architecture said, okay, we'll reduce that number to $59,551.25, but we're not doing any more work. That's extortion. There's no explanation of what the changes are. There's no explanation of what the changes are from, because there's no initial sworn statement.
Well, who requested the change initially?
She requested some changes.
Okay, she wanted something that wasn't in the original contract.
Yes.
Okay. Did she say in that request, when you tell me what it's going to cost, I'm going to take something else out?
She said, I want to know where the money's going so I can figure out how to deal with these changes. She didn't say, I want to take out countertops.
But you're saying that that's what the purpose of this is, to let people take out other things.
That's the main purpose of the
project. But what if they don't want to take anything else out?
Then they can say that. But that conversation never took place because there was no sworn statement given before
the letter of termination. Which
no, there was none given at the time he took the money for the architectural drawings. There was none given at the time he took the down payment for the construction agreement. There was none given at the time of this conversation.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
The four prerequisites for an original contractor's lien claim were met here, correct? As the trial court found, there was a valid contract, right?
The trial court found that it was valid because the trial court said that Northwest Millwork overruled Melissa.
Well, it doesn't overrule Melissa, but
it doesn't overrule
the trial court is bound. I'm sure you're familiar with the rules of stare decisis with respect to authority in the trial court. The trial court was bound to follow the most recent case on point from this district. Would you agree?
The most recent case on point from this district when this case was tried was not Northwest Millwork. We've cited later cases in our brief from this district and other districts saying you can't file a mechanics lien if you don't give a sworn statement.
Which case stands for that proposition where there hasn't been a request for a sworn statement? Which case? I could not find such a case.
Ambrose versus Biggs.
What's the cite to that case?
Ambrose versus Biggs, 156 LF 3rd 515, 509 Northeast 2nd 614, 108 Illinois Decisions 916. It's a 2nd District case, 1987, and it's cited on page 19.
Okay, those are agreed before. Those were decided before Millwork, even if you were correct.
Right. Yes, and Millwork doesn't overrule it because Millwork didn't talk about
the trial court is required to follow the most recent case on point. Opinion.
And it's the opinion in Northwest Millwork.
We're not bound by it, of course. And you
is not on point.
You could ask us to not follow it.
I'm asking you to not follow that. I'm asking you to clarify why the statute requires in Section 5B, little I, that this warning be in the contract, and it's for the protection of single-family owner-occupied homeowners who don't know the magic words sworn statement.
I have one more question. Even if what, even taking at your argument at face value, how does it undermine what the Supreme Court said in Miller that a statutory violation does not automatically render a contract unenforceable? It doesn't undermine Miller.
And Miller was decided after 5B was passed?
No, it doesn't matter when it was filed because the Supreme Court's pronouncement is clear.
The statute
itself does not provide a remedy.
The Supreme Court did not have Section 5B little I in front of it when it decided Miller. And the reason that it didn't is because after Miller was decided, the legislature said, obviously, the consumer rights brochure isn't doing its job. So we're going to tell contractors working on owner-occupied single-family homes, you must put this warning, boldface type, all caps, in your contract. Miller doesn't address that because it didn't exist. But it exists now.
You're saying that language that I cited from Miller has no effect.
I'm saying the legislature...
No, what the Supreme Court said in Miller, it's a broad pronouncement. It's not a narrow pronouncement with respect to a single statutory violation. It's a broad statement that ordinarily... And equitable principles would still apply, correct?
No, because the legislature acted after that saying you must give this warning. If you're going to say sworn statements are magic words... You've got to warn, not everybody, owner-occupied single-family homeowners. And that's who we're dealing with here.
Okay.
And they didn't get the warning.
Okay. Your time has expired. You'll have an opportunity to respond if you choose after counsel goes forward. Thank you. And Mr. Cherney, you may proceed. And will you pull that mic down just a little bit so that we can hear you? Thank you.
And I do have a hearing problem, so I will speak up.
Yeah. Well, I think, I know I do, and I think he does.
Good morning. Good morning. Please accord counsel. My name is Bill Cherney, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the appellees, defendants, counterplaintiffs, JB Architecture Group, and Jonathan A. Beertz. Based on the line of questioning, it's my understanding that this court knows the case law and is very conversant in what law does apply. This is quite simply a case where a homeowner or property owner, the Clarks, attempted to use the legal technicality to try and beat honest construction contractors out of their money. And they failed. Plaintiffs, once the mechanics lien was filed, and I had been put on notice that if I filed it, this would come, Clarks filed their four-count complaint. Quiet title, slander of title, consumer fraud, and declaratory judgment. JB filed a counterclaim to foreclose the mechanics lien and breach of contract, and during the pendency of the trial, also filed an amended complaint out of abundance of caution for accounts stated, quantum merit, and unjust enrichment. At the close of plaintiff's case in chief, the only count that survived plaintiff's complaint was a quiet title, which related to the mechanics lien complaint. During pretrial, motions were filed. It's a pretrial motion to dismiss. Both parties filed those motions. Both parties filed motions for summary judgment. So the court had two written orders, one for each one of those, and then the final judgment order. And I submit to the court that the trial court did hear all the evidence, was able to look and gauge the authenticity and the quality of the testimony of each one of the witnesses, and the testimony of Mr. Beards Mr. Barabaugh, who were the contractors, was unrefuted.
Well, our review of the contract itself is de novo. Would you agree?
I'm sorry?
Our review of the contract itself is a de novo review, correct?
That's correct.
And is it, it's uncontested, is it not, that the you did not the defendants did not provide plaintiffs with the required client's right brochure or the statutory notices in the construction agreements?
That's correct, and that's, that goes to your line of questioning with Mr. McConnell about what does Northwest Millwork represent. And Northwest Millwork represents that each one of these cases regarding sworn statements is based on facts. And so the court, the trial court, has to review whether the failure to submit or tender a sworn statement was a factual issue and was the reason for the homeowner or damages.
Who drafted the letter of termination?
Mr. McConnell.
Did Mr. McConnell ask for the sworn report or the brochure in the letter?
No, he did not. And that gets to the other point that...
My point is that, and I think it, at one point you brought that up, it was never requested, even after retaining counsel, correct?
Correct. And they should also bring up that Mr. McConnell's a family member of the Clarks. And
well,
that's
not unusual for family members to represent family members. It's sometimes not advisable, but it happens.
The notice of termination was from plaintiff's counsel. And that letter of termination came within a few days, maybe a week, from when there was an email exchange between the Clarks and Mr. Beertz about the fact that the Clarks didn't have the money to finish the project, as quoted in the contract. Although they did, at some time during these email exchanges, they did obtain a home equity line for $60,000. That's in the record. They could have paid JB, and JB would have said, okay, fine, I'm leaving. You can do whatever you want. But what the Clarks did was they waited until the project was nearly complete. And the photographs in the exhibits that were admitted, group photographs, exhibits 36, show what the uncompleted structure was. And this was a beauty salon so that Ms. Clark could run her business out of there and advertise her products on Facebook or one of those type of YouTube programs available. That's how she makes her money. So they waited, and then they canceled and then the notice of termination came. There was no request for sworn statements. And in fact, at some point, the court asked Mr. McConnell, why didn't he ask? He has 52 years of experience, as he just testified. His firm was called Construction Law Services. One could assume that a seasoned attorney, to avoid all this, would have said, just give us the sworn statements or let us know if anybody has the opportunity or the right as a subcontractor to place a subcontractor's lien on his property. He never asked. And obviously, he's already stated to this court that he knows about this. He's made allegations that are unsupported with any citation to any cases. This thing about the magic language, I can go through all the cases. I mean, there's no case that supports their argument, period. And that's what the trial court found. The trial court found by clear and convincing evidence that JB Architecture Group Inc. had made its case, both on a breach of contract and on a mechanics lien claim. And although not all the damages requested were given, the court did award JB statutory interest at 10% and attorney's fees. And that was based on argument and the motion to reconsider. It was in, I believe it was March 31st, that Mr. McConnell made argument that attorney's fees were exorbitant. This shouldn't happen. That shouldn't happen. He also, these magic words that should have been in the contract, that was the first time that he brought it up in a motion to reconsider. And the court, on record, said, you know, it was waived because it wasn't brought up during the trial or the pendency of the case. But regardless, the trial court would have rejected that argument anyway. So it didn't really matter. They have no argument. I mean, the trial court, the standard of review that Mr. McConnell didn't place in is whether the judgment was against the manifest weight of the evidence. It wasn't. The judge was very careful. Not only did he author one order, he did three. And his orders never changed with regard to citation of case law or the evidence that was in the record. The court has to consider whether the judgment is against the manifest weight of the evidence when an opposite conclusion is apparent. And there wasn't.
Clearly apparent.
Right. So, that's the extent of my argument. I ask that the judgment of the trial court be affirmed.
How does the request for a breakdown of expenses change anything? Does that change anything?
No.
Why not? I mean, I think counsel was trying to argue that it was, that's essentially a request for a sworn report.
Well, I'm sorry.
That's essentially, counsel's arguing that was essentially a request for a sworn report. When the homeowners asked for a breakdown of expenses.
They were provided.
Right.
And that was, Mr. Baird's testified to that. I don't recall exactly, but.
That's not a substitute for a sworn report.
No. No, and that's what the court ruled. And there's no case law that supports that argument. Nothing. Not one. And again, I come back to my argument that Mr. McConnell was a seasoned attorney, and he was obviously on the case prior to terminating him. This was nothing more than an attempt to stiff the contractors. That's all it was. And this court or no court should be allowed to allow this kind of gamesmanship to occur. They did the work. There was no testimony refuting it or to the contrary. There was no testimony that said that the work was improper or inefficient. We even brought in the chief building inspector from the village of Montgomery to testify that there was no violation of any code or any law, that everybody was properly licensed. And we still, we come to this, that any excuse not to pay is an excuse.
Now, what's the date of the actual termination letter that was reported?
It's Exhibit 157. The date of the termination is May 11, 2021. Okay. The email exchanges were just subsequent to that, but I don't have the email exchanges in front of me, but they were the clerks were telling Mr. Beards that there was a money issue and they needed to look for funds. And so they had to make some adjustments. And Mr. Beards said, fine, you know, these are the adjustments and I'd like to get paid for the work I already did. That's not extortion. That's part of contract. That was in the contract. That was the benefit of the bargain. They agreed to pay and they didn't. They come up with these excuses that the Home Repair and Remodeling Act, that the Mechanics Lien Act says this or that. Those are just excuses that can't be accepted. Mr. McConnell should have said, well, why don't you give us sworn statements from your subcontractors and then we'll pay you what the balance of the work you already did and you can go on your merry way and we'll hire somebody else to finish off the project. Didn't do that. I'm not going to make the allegation that this was a plan, that this was somewhere in the works ahead of time, but this is what happened. This is the fact. And this should not be allowed to get away with paying nothing. Now, in the briefs that the appellant has submitted, now they're admitting that there was a contract and there was money owed. But they're saying, well, okay, but, you know, we shouldn't have to pay all these other things like attorney's fees to the defendant or the statutory interest. But there's nothing in the record that shows that they should be absolved of those responsibilities. The 10% interest is statutory. The attorney's fees was up to the discretion of the court. And I did testify under oath that as to my attorney's fees, and the judge accepted that testimony over Mr. McConnell's objection. And that's how we got to $143,000 from a project that was somewhere significantly less than that. But that's the risk they took. They have to suffer the consequences.
But those, the attorney's fees and costs were left out of the judgment as entered, weren't they?
The attorney's fees were in $143,000.
But I guess what I'm trying to say is they were included in the bottom line of the judgment as entered. Are you with me?
Yes.
The judgment you proposed had a separate line item for attorney's fees and costs, correct?
Yes.
And that line item, those two line items, were omitted from the judgment as entered, right?
That's correct. And
But the trial court found in his order of March 31, 2025, that the fees were what they were, and, you know, what they had been stated in your judgment as proposed. And that dollar amount is the exact same. The bottom line figure is the exact same in the proposed judgment as in the judgment as entered, right?
That's correct.
Thank you. Nothing further.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What, Mr. McConnell, if you wish to reply, you may do so at this time.
Two things briefly. Number one, I repeatedly asked for sworn statements from Mr. Bieritz. In his deposition at page C754, I said, could you make a current sworn statement? This is April 6, 2023. Could you make a current sworn statement that balances to the amount that he's charging? Mr. Cherney objected, saying it's actually more than this amount. Then I asked, could you make a sworn statement that balances to this amount or a greater amount? The answer is yes. The next question, will you do that and produce it? Mr. Cherney said he's not answering that question. He's not producing a sworn statement.
This is after the litigation began. This, in your letter of termination, the question that I asked was, in your letter of termination, did you cite provisions of the act requiring a sworn
yes,
statement?
Yes, I cited 5B1 little I and 5B3 as the reason, one of the reasons for the termination, failure to comply with those. If I could go on.
Wouldn't that, I mean, I'm, you know, the purpose of an appendix that you put in the briefs is to facilitate decision in the case. I know I can look at the record. I'm not saying I can't look at the record. But normally, those types of documents, like the construction agreement and any letters that you wrote during the period of time before.
I can give you an exhibit number for the.
But which exhibit is it? Are you talking about the exhibit that is on a standard form?
No, I'm talking about my termination notice.
That I'm just.
It's Exhibit 17.
And what page is the?
It's E77.
But I'm talking about in this, in the brief index. Is it in your, is your letter in the brief index that you've provided?
It's cited in the brief as page E77 of the exhibits in the record.
Okay. Well, it's not here. Okay.
And it says, JB Architecture's purported contract dated December 14, 2020, and signed by Roger and Elise Clark on December 15, 2020, is terminated for violation of the Illinois Home Repair and Remodeling Act, 815 ILCS 513/1 and following, and for failure to comply with the provisions of the Illinois Mechanics Lien Act, including but not limited to 770 ILCS 60/5 b, i, and iii. So he knew at that time.
Well, he knew that you thought that they, or somebody knew that you thought they were in violation, but you didn't ask for a sworn statement there, did you? I mean, you're worried about magic words.
I didn't ask for a sworn statement there because counsel had called me up and said, you're not getting out of this. He cursed at me,
okay.
And he said, I'm
following. You're going off the record.
That's not in the record.
It's not in the record.
It's not in the record.
I know that counsel characterized you as a bully at one point when this litigation began. Do not try to bully us. Let us ask the question. The question I asked counsel was, did you ask for a sworn report in the termination letter? And the answer to that question was, no, you did not.
I said that that was the reason for termination. I did not say give us one.
Right. You didn't never requested a sworn statement before the litigation began. Correct?
No. I requested it repeatedly after the litigation began, and there's nothing in the statute that says that those requests are invalid. And he said he could make a sworn statement, but he wouldn't do it. Repeatedly. As a member, this is at page 769 of the common law record. As a member of the AIA, are you familiar with the AIA form of sworn statement? Yes. Could you fill that form out now with respect, can I finish?
Yeah.
With respect to this project, as far as you and your subs worked on it, I could. Would you? I go by the advice of my counsel with that, as counsel told him not to answer. So we continued during discovery to try and get a current sworn statement or an original sworn statement. And he wouldn't do it. And the reason he wouldn't do it is the same reason contractors don't put these warnings in their contracts. Because they want to say, unless you use the magic words, sworn statement, we don't have to give you one.
Do you have any other, your time is up, do you have any other summary?
I have one other thing that we raised in our brief, and the counsel has never addressed. In our notices of appeal, we asked, for affirmance of the paragraph in Judge Prince's order of April 1st, 2025, paragraph 11, finding that plaintiff, paren, and I put this paren, because the plaintiffs are Elise and Roger Clark, for principal interest and cost, the following sums from defendant J.B., defendant, paren, J.B. Architecture Group, Inc., and Jonathan Bewitz, close paren, total principal and interest to $85,866.97.
Okay, that raises an issue for me. When I saw this in your reply brief, it sent me to the project of understanding what it was you were complaining about, which took a certain amount of time, which I'm happy to devote to making sure justice is done. But my question for you is, did you raise this in your opening brief?
Yes.
Okay.
That we asked for affirmance and that there was no offset in Judge Prince's order.
No, I mean argue it. What I meant, I agree in your notice of appeal, you do appeal. Excuse me, counsel. Just, I have, you know, the ability to speak and intend to do so. I think, is it the April 1 order, the judgment order?
Yes.
The judgment of foreclosure and sale. You did appeal that. I get that. That's not my question. My question is, you raised an argument that it took a while to discern, but what I understood as best I could from what was stated in your reply brief, you seem to be saying that the judgment is not, for lack of a better phrase, net of set off. You seem to be saying, well, that's the judgment is the $85,000, and from that, we are entitled to a set off of the monies we paid.
This is what I said at page 26 of my brief. The trial court's failure to provide for its money judgment in favor of JB Architecture to be offset by its finding in paragraph 11 of its final order, C-2139, that there is
okay,
now...
Okay, you're right. Yeah, thank you. And I'll tell you what. Now I know why I was confused. You put that in your conclusion of your brief. I'm not making any complaint here. It's just an observation. I went back looking. Where in the heading is this issue raised?
Never.
Okay. To the extent that raises the issue in your opening brief, and you met it again in your reply brief, you pointed out they didn't say anything about it, and you're right, they didn't. I'm still speaking, counsel. My point is, after I set to the project of figuring out what we were trying to complain about, then I understood that the trial court, in his written order, page 18, he netted out the setup. He netted out what they had already paid and entered a judgment amount that I think was...
No.
Excuse me. About $65,000. And then added to that interest, and that is how you get up to the $85,000 figure, which is in the judgment of foreclosure and sale that was entered April 1. I'm still speaking. And you will find... that if you're not planning what you're going to say, you'll have more ability to understand what my question is or what my concern is. The trial court netted it out. $85,000 was the figure to which was added in the judgment order, although there were a couple lines left out, the $53,000 in attorney's fees and like $4,200 in costs. That netted up to the figure that... that you mentioned, which is, I think, $143,000, something like that. But as I read the record, one, the trial court clearly entered, gave fees in the amount of $53,000. That's in a separate order. It's not in the judgment of foreclosure and sale as entered. It is in the judgment of foreclosure and sale as proposed. And the trial court took care to make sure that, as I understand the record, took care to make sure that your clients were given the benefit of the set-off, that they deserved their previous payments. Thank you.
The judge interpreted what he signed as being part of the judgment in favor of Bewitz. Although it says it's in favor of the Clarks, and he never set off the $85,000 against the total that was entered in favor of Bewitz.
I'm going to make one comment. You're way beyond the scope of what a rebuttal should be. So you're done.
Okay. Yes, the time is up, and we will take this matter under consideration. We will issue a decision in due course. We now stand in recess.